Hello and welcome once again to Crazy Comics and Stories. It's me, your charming and delightful old Uncle Rat Bastard. And at the other end of the series of tubes and wires that we call the internets is Joe, Crazy Writer. How you doing today, Joe?
Oh my God! Oh my God! There's not enough paper in America for comic books right now. Ah! What are we gonna do? I got a hoard. Mine. This is mine. And this is mine. Okay, this goes off eBay. This is mine. Oh, okay. And this. Well, I gotta have this. No. Ah, I ripped it. No. Oh, when you were only 2 weeks old. Oh, the humanity. What are we gonna do? Panic! How can you be so calm, Corey?
Most of the comics I get are digital, and they're still electrons.
See, that worries me most of all. If you really want to panic yourself, there's an old crack.com article about how delicate the interwebs is. How a society on the interwebs was largely built upon trust, and how it just takes one or two bad actors to knock it out. They were talking, of course, this was back when some dumbass 16-year-old hack took a virus that he shouldn't have and altered it, but it escaped. And what it did, it went around the world and shut down all the banking centers. I'm not even talking about like if a sunspot were to hit a modern society the way it did. Was it 1812? Blew out all the telegraphs? So we are literally one tragedy away from all of our digital online stuff being useless. And I point at you, of course, mister. I waited a week to get a new fucking computer. But also, oh my God, how long was Facebook out yesterday?
As we're recording. Hours.
The 6 hours where we had to talk to each other.
No, we didn't.
Yeah, there is that. I honestly, I know.
I like, we had to talk to each other. No, I was at work. So I just worked.
Yeah.
Now, here's the thing about though.
You're working online, so it doesn't invalidate what
right.
The consumer could.
But even if I were in the office, if something like that happened, most offices now, like I get. The servers for what I do, they're not in Minneapolis.
Well, it doesn't really matter where they are unless they're in a lead bunker somewhere.
Right.
But it means
that everybody's medical records, medical coverage, all of that would be gone. Comics would be a long way down the line.
Well,
but
there's
you know,
also,
you said, oh,
you haven't even touched upon how bad the United States utilities are.
Oh,
because again, these are all private companies. Case in point, well, there's two cases. Look at California. Look at China. China's got problems now with rolling blackouts because their utilities can't keep up with the demand, especially post-COVID. So we're all basically sitting on a house of cards. And the worst part about it is. And we haven't even gotten back to the not enough paper in America for comic books right now. What would happen to this national treasure of a podcast if the lights went out in Georgia or the sun decided to blow the millions and millions of lines of power wires?
Yeah, I don't know.
No, I don't either. Anyways, getting back to there's not enough paper in America for comic books.
There's more to that story than meets the eye as well.
Oh, of course. This was from Bleeding Cool, which, first of all, is a suspect source to begin with.
You want to know why they are putting in delays for the big books that we get?
Probably because if the paper costs are going up, they don't have time to raise the paper or comic book prices.
Nope. Remember earlier this year when the ship got stuck in the Suez Canal?
Oh my God, are you saying we could have canal problems? A root canal?
If you take a look at shipping lanes, because of that delay, you know, they rerouted ships, which caused delays. All these delays are kind of domino affecting. And if you read up on the shipping delays, there are thousands of ships just kind of parked outside the U.S. waiting for their turn to come in and unload.
Ports, not to mention lack of vessel space on the ships.
Yep.
Not to mention rising costs of containers. I actually read a kind of sadder article where some of these, seamen have been stuck on their boats for months, if not years, because they can't get off at port.
Yep.
Usually when a ship docks, takes a certain amount of time to unload it, and the crew's allowed on shore. But because of all the different COVID regulations, you need to be vaccinated here. One guy said he's been vaccinated 9 times and still hasn't been given any shore leave because he gets to whatever country and they just won't let anybody off.
And because they're literally stranded. And that's one of the things, you know, how there are all these governors and people who are saying no vaccine passports. That's why U.S. is not issuing vaccine passports for COVID. They issue them for everything else. You know, if you join the military, you get like 20 vaccination shots.
Oh, yeah. Talk to our good buddy Turbo. He'll tell you all about vaccination shots.
And, you know, you get a vaccination passport so that you can go overseas. Well, because you have all these governors who are saying no vaccine passports, and the federal government to get anything done is next to impossible. All of these things are kind of cascading to the point where it's causing problems with getting comics that are published overseas into the U.S., which I want to tell people, very, very few comics are published in the U.S. Most of your hardcovers and softcovers are published in China or Canada. Most of your regular comics are published in Canada. Matter of fact, I just got comics a couple of days ago. So let's see if they tell you where it's published. This one does not. But I know that most DC books are published in Canada. So here's my new Batman Urban Legends. Boy, that is a cool, cool cover. I love Batman Urban Legends. Let's see. Printed by Transcontinental Printing, Interweb Montreal, a division of Transcontinental Printing, Inc., Boucherville, Quebec, Canada. So there are a whole bunch of factors in this. To me, the biggest factor is that companies got rid of storage space, you know, warehouses. And we went to, back in the 90s, most companies followed Walmart's lead by having what they call just-in-time shipping, which is they don't take the stuff and put it in their warehouse, and then the store says, hey, I need this, so it comes from the warehouse. It's they go to the manufacturer and say, hey, I need this, and the manufacturer ships it directly. Yes, boy, it sure saves money, but if there's ever a problem in manufacturing, if there's ever a problem in supply chain, that's what leads to those shelves, those store shelves being empty. Goes back to at the beginning of the pandemic when you couldn't get toilet paper and Lysol and stuff like that because everybody had moved to that just in time. So if there's ever a demand on things, going back to the manufacturer, rather than going back to your warehouse and telling the manufacturer, hey, we're seeing more demand for this. It's nope, you go to the manufacturer who then has to ramp up. So they have to either give people a lot more overtime, which during a pandemic, and you can't get people to work because they're sick or it's not safe. So now we've got all of the chickens coming home to roost all over everything, but especially when it comes to paper products like comics. Joe, you know another reason why there's a paper shortage?
Oh, there's just not one. All North American mills oversold into 2022.
Yeah.
Not enough paper.
You know, the toilet paper shortage and things like that, but also book sales have gone up around 40% since the pandemic started.
Publishers are going to work the most expensive papers first before they start working on the lesser type paper. You know, you're talking things like coated, uncoated, graphic paper. You know, they're saying their inventories have been exhausted for almost all grades of that. However, is showing signs of strengthening, because I talked about comic bags being hard to find in some quarters, but that seems to be loosening up a little, maybe.
And the other thing that is going on with plastic is more and more companies are trying to find ways to sort of recycle it.
After dumping it in landfills, saying, oh, we're recycling it. Oh, you know what? No, we're kidding. Let's really recycle the plastic now.
Have you heard about what the toy companies are doing?
Oh, I talked about that last week. Hasbro's actually asking for people, if you got toys you're not using, certain toys, not all toys, send them in. They'll give you a credit dollars off for new toys. They're talking baby products. The only thing I noticed in my limited view are they're asking for Matchbox cars. Not Hot Wheels, just Matchbox cars. So I thought that was kind of interesting, at least from Hasbro's standpoint.
I also find it really interesting that even Hot Wheels cars are selling out.
Well, that's the same problem. They're made in Malaysia for the most part, and they're probably sitting offshore in container ships waiting to come in. This Christmas is going to be really, really interesting. If you're a parent and you're looking for the toy, you better start Christmas shopping now, because people are thinking there may not be the big toys sitting on the shelves like there have been the last couple of years. You know, and this is just the supply system being snapped back after not enough demand. Now there's too much demand. And, you know, in a couple of years, we'll look back on this National Treasure of a podcast, assuming no, collapse of the interwebs, utilities blowing up, hacking us for malware, whatever, and go, look, you were wrong. Just like we look back in all those books on the 70s about the dangers of overpopulation.
Well, if we want to get into that, one of the things that has saved us from the danger of overpopulation is a lot of stuff that people are upset about, which is factory farming, GMOs, rapid advances in being able to grow food and animals much, much faster.
Although with global warming, which, you know, we're who knows, maybe two decades from now, we'll think, oh, that was so cute. But what's weird is the zones where certain food products are grown, if they continue, I should say, changing, you know, the climate seems to be drifting northward. So right now the Corn Belt could be part of Canada, Southern Canada, you know, in a decade or two, if things keep warming up as fast as they can.
Yeah. Now, one thing
that's
I wanted to say.
That's not what we're here to talk about. We're here just to panic. Panic! Oh, I hate panicking.
One thing I wanted to bring up, you know, last week you gave me shit for buying stuff from large multinational companies. I have a question for you, Joe.
Amazon, the largest unregulated.
Right. But I have a question for you. I want to buy the Black Widow Blu-ray /DVD.
Is it available?
Yeah. It's been out since last month.
All right.
Name my mom and pop shop where I could get it.
Well, due to Kmart, Sears, Walmart, Target, there are no mom and pop shops that do videos anymore. There's one Blockbuster Video left in America. Every mom and pop shop is gone.
The only small businesses that are kind of in every area, restaurants, and I always frequent the locally owned restaurants. I rarely go to a chain, and if I do go to a chain, it's usually something that's franchised, and comic shops.
It's amazing that nobody has figured out how to chain a comic shop yet.
I think it's because the margins are so small. And for a lot of comic shops this week, they got ugly.
Uh-oh.
Joe, what was the big change in comics that happened this week?
Oh, everybody! I think Penguin is shipping books now.
Yes, Penguin is shipping comics.
They don't know what the blankety blank they're doing.
Brian Hibbs, who owns Comic Experience in San Francisco, does a incredibly infrequent column on The Beat called Tilting at Windmills, wrote today on his face tab, the first words for private comic retailer groups is that far, far too many retailers are having cataclysmic damages problems from the first PRH shipping week from Marvel books. I think I've counted roughly 3-1 complaining versus all is well, but it's kind of impossible to suss out the signal versus noise because of Facebook's nature. His damages are 8.8%, which are 9 times the average a week for Diamond. Some folks are reporting 60% damages, and Bleeding Cool, which is really the only place that covers this, even though they are a gossip site, has a lot of pictures of it, including DCB Service states that, DCB Service, we are writing to let you know that the shipment of Marvel items coming from Penguin Random House has gotten lost on its way to us. It is currently being looked for since we have not received any of our Marvel items for this week. We are unable to start processing shipments. They then go through a bunch of tweets and notes they have gotten, including pictures. And it looks like they're sending it in normal book boxes with no packing material. Let's see here. Diamonds had shipping problems, but never anything like this. We got one box filled with basically kindling, one box we'd never find acceptable from Diamond. In this case, we are reluctantly considering it good enough just to have some product. And according to the website, there's a third box of some pretty major books, Immortal Hulk number 50 and all the Star Wars, plus some other stuff that they haven't even bothered to ship out yet. People are getting a note from the people who pack it, but the problem is they're not. They're using thin boxes instead of, you know, Diamond has some sturdy boxes. I know when I get them.
Oh, yeah. I actually love them because they're beautiful for shipping out toys and oversized books and things like that.
But they also, I know Diamond, they would stack the books and then have a divider between the two. When you get them from Lunar, which is also DCB Service, they have, for the bigger boxes, they have this plastic sort of packing. It's almost like bubble wrap, but thicker. And if you get smaller, they actually use a foam that they put it molds itself to the books in the box. But it's starting to look like Penguin Random House just is putting them in a box and saying, here, good luck. Not a good first week. And that means a lot of the Marvel books from the last week or two, and maybe for the rest of this month at least, are going to be a little rarer. So if you see them in good condition, you may want to pick them up. Because Marvel may have
also,
to... Marvel may have to go to second prints.
Marvel, I'm going to warn you. I will drop you as fast as I fucking drop DC. If you don't get this straightened out, you may have a bunch of slavering fanboys out there that gotta have their Marvel fix. I ain't one of them. And I've been buying Marvel since 1977. If you keep fucking this up, I will drop you like I dropped DC. You know, I don't have, like you said, Corey, and you got digital options. I can wait for the graphic novel. I don't have to buy Marvel. There are hundreds of people dying for my dollars. If you're going to take us for granted, or maybe you don't give a fuck, you know, we are a niche market. We are peons in terms of the multi-mouse empire. And I'm sure if comic books disappeared from the menu, be it DC or Marvel, the corporate overlords wouldn't care because they can still pump out their movies based on whatever comic character they want because they own them. Well, Ditko Errors and Ultraverse aside. So, yeah, this, you know, again, a couple years from now, this may be just a blip and we'll look back finally on this episode. Or this could be the new 52 bump. You know, where I say, you know what, Corey? I didn't order a fucking thing from Marvel this month. Want to? They just don't have anything because they can't ship it. You've got people like me buying these out of habit. If anything breaks that habit, I will go on to something else. Right, DC? Here endeth the rant.
But that's not what we wanted to talk about this week.
No. Oh, heaven forbid.
30 minutes we talk about all the chaos in the comic business.
Yeah.
Oh, would I hate to be a retailer this week.
I'll send a quick note to Tim.
I would beat my head against a wall.
I'll send a quick note to Tim and just ask him how this week went when Wednesday flies by. I may have to run out next week and try to find a preview somewhere. Because if we're not getting our comic shipment, I won't be getting a previews. And I do like looking at the previews. You know, it may be I'll look at previews the way I looked at Sears catalog. I ain't getting none of it, but it's fun to look at.
Well, I know they have not updated the shipping lists on DCB service. They did update the website earlier today for October. And I already have my previews, so I'm kind of going through and making my orders and stuff. But, you know, when you look at the unshipped items and you hear about how, well, you know, all these books are off the coast. And another thing about that is they don't when they print comics, you know, or any sort of book in China, they are not given priority. They are mostly used as ballast because they're very heavy. It's not a priority. And that's why when you order a omnibus, the files are all already there. Matter of fact, a lot of the omnibuses they're doing, I have the Captain America Volume 2 from the Golden Age. They literally just sent the files over from the Masterwork 3 and 4. The 6 months is for the printing and then the shipping. So it's going to be really interesting to see what happens on all of these fronts. I know one of the things that Marvel Unlimited has done lately to kind of pull you in a little more, they are doing some exclusives on Marvel Unlimited. And the way they are formatted, they can't be printed on paper because they're, you know, that digital format, they use the screen differently. It's not like the Marvel Infinite comics, which were a fun idea, but you had to actually go and buy them. This is more, oh, well, you know, we're giving an extra story or, in the case of Captain America, a story that is a little too controversial and probably would get them in a lot of trouble if they printed it and sold it to comic shops because people at Fox News or One American News or Newsmax got wind of it. They would go, oh, look at these commie Disney bastards destroying Captain America, like they did with the Captain America miniseries. Or even back after the death of Captain America, when it was Bucky infiltrating protesters, far-right wing protesters. I was reading Ed Brubaker's interview lately, and he talked about how he just wanted them to be generic protesters, but the letterer, who wasn't in the U.S., watched the news to get ideas of what was on protest signs and just used what he saw in the news for the protest signs. And Marvel printed it, shipped it out, didn't think anything of it. All of a sudden, they're all over Fox News for a week about how they're anti-American commies when the artist and not the artist, the letterer was just pulling stuff out of the Tea Party protests. So it's, imagine you're an editor having to juggle all of this crap right now. I do not envy anybody working for a comic company. What was our topic this week?
I don't remember.
Oh, Fave Five superhero teams.
Oh, yeah.
I love doing Fave Fives. Fave Fives are something I like. Because it makes you kind of sort through in your mind the wheat from the chaff, but also everybody in the world loves a top 10 or a top 5 list.
Oh yeah,
even I, when I'm looking through on YouTube for just something about comics or wrestling or video games, you know, just something to watch during my break at work or over lunch, I will choose, oh, look, 10 movies that were better than they should have been. 5 superheroes who were ruined in this event. So we're doing Fave 5 superhero teams.
Neat.
Joe, do you want to go first?
Sure. My first one up is the Justice League of America. And, of course, I will give the caveat because, I mean, it's been, 1960 was when they first appeared way back in Brave and Bold number 28, kind of a revival of the Justice Society of America, which I wasn't aware of until reading more of the Justice League of America. I'm going to jump in where I first started, and that would be, of course, 1978, issue number 161, where a different cat-suited, deep cleavage Zatanna appeared. And let's see, I can't read the title. I had it all set up, but I left my readers upstairs. But she's blasting away the ballot box because they voted her in. And she said, me? Join the Justice League? Never! And of course, all the leaguers around her reacting in dismay because it was always a great honor to be asked to the Justice League of America. I don't know what it was that got me to start reading Justice League, because my reading way back then, it was, let's see, Spider-Man related. It slowly branched out. I remember trying Superman, but at the time Superman wasn't that good, you know, and I was always cognizant of the fact of Golden Age and Silver Age. It could be because I read a Byers. Well, I wasn't reading Byers yet. It could be I had an Overstreet. Golden Age reprints were a lot easier to find. Even with starting with Justice League of America, I was able to backtrack quite a ways backwards. I mean, I got all the oversized ones where they were 60 cents, and that included the first Ultra, a JLA crossover where they went back in time and met some of the Western heroes, Adam's Wedding, crossover with Supergirl. You know, I got farther back. I ran into Shazam. I ran into the Cary Bates, where he appeared on Earth Prime for the first time. And he became evil Cary Bates. And of course, I believe that was my introduction to Julius Schwartz, too, because when they're trying to explain this to it, and he was like, bah, leave me alone. I want to eat my beans in peace. So I was able to go quite a ways back because back issues weren't crazily priced. And many of them, especially when you got to the 100 pagers, had reprints in them. Going forward from the Justice League, as I just got a, you know, we kept going forward. Once they figured out what was going on with Zatanna and why she was so crazy, let's see, where am I getting? Oh, they fought the New Gods. Firestorm joined in. There was a really goofy Batman in a bat cycle in outer space. Even I thought was stupid. Issue 200 was really cool. Gary Conway, Larry Wien Len Wein were doing the writing. Ross Andrew was helping out. Dick Dillon was doing the art. George Perez jumped on, like I said before, when they fought Darkseid around 181. So it was just a lot of fun. I stuck with Justice League for a while. It was kind of neat because it was all inclusive. It was like for the meager price, I think they were 60 cents back then. I got a lot of Justice League for the money, and you get all the different characters. I stayed with them into the Detroit era, which was whatever. And Crisis came around that. And of course, afterwards came Justice League International. I enjoyed the Grant Morrison run. His run was spectacular because what I loved about it was that he included what was going on in the other books, but it didn't overpower the story. Superman showed up one day as a blue Superman. If you're reading Superman, you knew what was going on. If you didn't, it didn't matter. There was even a short story whether they should let Superman in with new powers. And when they went to Batman, Batman was busy doing something. He goes, bah, he's Superman. He's in. You know, like, why are you even questioning this? Wonder Woman showed up as, that was the whole deal when Wonder Woman, did she die or disappear or went to the gods? And her mother took over. So there was always things like that. There were big stories involved. Plastic Man was there. It was just a lot of fun. And I've always enjoyed Justice League. I kind of backed off it recently with the whole, I did try the New 52. I did enjoy it when it restarted New 52, and I hung with it through the Darkseid War. I think that was around issue 50 and then dropped. Recently jumped back on when Brian Bendis was doing it, because I do like it. I'm not thrilled with it, but I'm always interested to see where he's going to go. It's just in comics, it's just a fun series that I've enjoyed. I've got a lot of fond memories. You know, those earlier issues I talked about are now $20, $30 books in mint. I think they're probably in book form somewhere. I must have them. It's just fun to read, you know. I've enjoyed the movies. At least I like the Snyder cut off as more than I admitted. I enjoyed the animated one as well. Trying to read some of the old Silver Age, I kind of cocked my head, but there were gems. The earliest books I had, of course, was the first Silver Age Justice League crossover. I remember I bought them, I think, $25 a piece. Pat was talking to the dealer. His name was John at the time, and he was trying to get him to deal on it. You know, would you go like maybe 15 a piece? And it's like, you know, these are key books. And John said, okay, you know, I'm going to take up your offer, so I'll take your $50. When I come by, just play along. And so Pat and I were sitting, you know, just waiting for someone to come up to our table. And the dealer, John dropped them. I said, you know, Joe, I'm real tired of looking at these. I'll give them both to you for $20. I said, oh, okay. So I gave him $20. And Pat's jaw was like, just fun memories. So for me, the first team I've loved and enjoyed would be the Justice League. And to me, it's always, you got to have the big boys in it. That's crucial for the Justice League. Otherwise, you might as well just go to Detroit. What's your first or whatever on your list there, Corey?
Before I go to that, have I ever told you how the Justice League got me to read the Legion of Superheroes?
No.
I was just starting to branch off into DC because I was a Marvel kid. I was a Marvel zombie. But I picked up Batman because it said on the cover, Roy Thomas, Gary Conway, and Gene Colan. It was like, oh, wow, I wondered where those guys went. And after reading a few issues of that, I said, well, I ought to pick up the big book, like their Avengers. And I remembered Super Friends, but I didn't remember, and they never called them the Justice League in Super Friends. They just called them the Super Friends. And, you know, this was before I had read 100 bajillion, you know, magazines and Overstreets and everything. So I'm looking on the rack, you know, DC, Legion of Superheroes. Oh, that must be it. So I picked it up. And it was starting the lead up to the Great Darkness War. So I'm reading it, and it's like, oh, this is set in the year 3000. I think I got the wrong book. I did not pick up the Justice League until issue 200, which one of the better books to start with, to be honest with you. But that was my introduction to the Justice League, was the Legion of Superheroes. My number five book, because I do it countdown-wise, the new Teen Titans. Not the Teen Titans, not the Titans, the new Teen Titans, the book that was created by Marv Wolfman and George Perez up until it got canceled around... Well, they did the Baxter book, and then the Baxter went to, like, 125. Then they did a complete reboot of it and changed what it was and everything. But that book, another one where I went, oh, look, it's Marv Wolfman and George Perez. I wondered where they went. It blew me away. It was so well done. Each character seemed to have a reason why they were with the team. Perez's art was being inked by Romeo Tangal, who was perfect for Perez. Perez's inking at Marvel had been up and down. You know, he's got Joe Sinnott on the Fantastic Four, and on the Avengers, he's got Vince Coletta. And on this book, he had, you know, this Frank Chiamonte, who was okay. But I was blown away by how good it was. And I've spent a lot of time kind of thinking how and when the book fell apart. Because even after it fell apart, it was still kind of worth reading. You know, you got into the Titans hunt and all that. But I think it was when they started it, they had an idea of where each character was and where their story would end. So, you know, with this character, their story would end when this happened. And with this character, their story would end when this happened. And they pretty much ended all the stories right before Crisis on Infinite Earths. Then they did Crisis on Infinite Earths. And George Perez came back and did one more story. And I really think after that, they were like, oh, crap, I don't know what to do with these characters anymore. So it just kind of floundered for a while. But, man, that early run and the first, I would say, up until like a year after Crisis, one of the best books being published, so good that when they did the final Marvel and DC crossover in the 80s, it was the new Teen Titans and the X-Men. It wasn't Justice League. It wasn't any of the other ones. It was the new Teen Titans, which at that point had only been around for 30 issues. I have liked the Titans after that. It's gone up and down. Some of the Titans runs, like Jeff Johns and a few others, have been fantastic. Some have been just bland and boring. But I always like the Teen Titans more than I like the Justice League. Joe, what's your number four?
Were you on board? Were you reading DC Comics Presents when they premiered?
No, I came on to New Teen Titans around issue 15.
See, I was reading DC Comics Presents pretty regularly. So when issue 26 hit, not only did it have a kick-ass Green Lantern Superman team up, which I love because some villain took Green Lantern's ring and then Superman went to confront it.
And wasn't that is, by Jim Starlin, I believe.
Yep. Kapow! And Green Lantern is like covering his ears and Superman comes back. He kind of flips the ring to him. Yeah, there's not much that can stand up to me when I really put my mind to it. But it also had the insert with the first appearance of Teen Titans. So I was on it from issue one. And I guess I'm lucky. I'm not lucky enough to actually have a copy of Teen Titans number 26 near mint. The guide says it's 280. I know it'd have to be way above that because it's appearance of not only Cyborg, of Raven, of Starfire. It's their first appearance as a team. Plus, you got the kick-ass Jim Starlin story with George Perez art, Jim Starlin art. So, yeah, keep your issue of that in some heavy Mylar. I don't think Mylar is in short supply. So, for me, the next team was quite possibly the last thing I ever read at Marvel New. And I'm talking about the X-Men. Again, this is back. Let's see. We're talking probably 1981 or so, because the first X-Men I actually ever read. Well, I talk about how I picked up 120 because Spider-Man appeared in it. And I thought, oh, this is cool. Spider-Man's in it and Arcade's in it. I knew that from early issue Marvel team up. But then 121, which was also on the shelf, there was no Spider-Man. He just had made a cameo. And I was too naive to realize that. And I just, I'm not going to read X-Men. I knew about X-Men because I actually, I read magazines, Overstreet, you know, things like that. Vaguely aware of new X-Men. But the first one I picked up was X-Men 137, The Death of Phoenix. Oversized issue. I recognized Cyclops. I recognized Marvel Girl. Had no idea what the Phoenix Saga was about. I was able to piece together quite a bit of it. I mean, I remember those three packs at Marvel Comics at Kmart. Remember ripping one apart just to get at 135 because I didn't want the other two lame-o ones. They're probably, you know, first appearance of, you know, characters way worth now. I was able to get back as far as 108, and then I also found me, I'm trying to figure the first appearance of what's his name from Alpha Flight fought Wolverine, and then he disappeared, and we didn't.
109.
109. So 109, 108, and there was one other one back there. Pat Gruber, my old partner, let me read his X-Men 95 to date. So I was up to date, and I got the whole story. I've never owned an original copy of Giant Size X-Men 1. I did get and I'm not going to look it up because it'll take too much time, but I did once at Schindler's find an X-Men, I think it was 30. It had Banshee. It had Spider-Man in it. It was back when Peter Parker was riding a scooter. So I caught that, you know, and then of course, by that time, X-Men was hot, not hot like they are now in the hundreds of dollars for mint shapes, but, you know, I was able to get a hold of Marvel 2-in-1 annual one, which had X-Men, Marvel team up number 4, which had X-Men. Did not quite understand what was going on, but what was cool about it is that when I kept reading forward, the very next issue, 138, was kind of a synopsis of the origin of the X-Men, which told pretty much the entire story to date, including the what happened in Phoenix. And, of course, a lot of spoilers were given away, but, you know, I didn't care. This was also my first awareness of John Byrne art, which I immediately fell in love with. I read X-Men probably all the way through until I started running Hot Comics. So you're talking, when did I say that was out? 1980 was when 137 came out. I started my shop in 182. The 90s for X-Men were a blur. I mean, I remember jumping on board with Jim Lee, first appearance of Bischoff, the infamous X-Men 1 that had five different copies and then a gatefold cover. Part of my problems I had is like Claremont never, he would throw out things and never really come back to them. They had a big thing where, let's see, where were we? Was it 146 or 148 where, you know, Siren was brought in, Banshee was brought in, all these other characters were brought in, and then 149, it's like it never happened. I found out later, of course, through Comics Interview, everything after when 37 was kind of hodgepodge because Shooter kind of made them rejugger everything. So he can be forgiven for that. But eventually it just got to the point where the X-Men villains were so powerful, you could never defeat them. Okay, Apocalypse, you're going to jail. Don't break out or nothing, will you? Okay, you too, Proteus. Just behave yourselves behind bars, will you? All they could do is defer them, and they would come back. There were some fun crossovers. I mean, when Jean Grey came back in Fantastic Four, I thought, well, you're kind of taking away the fun of 137, but, you know, whatever, I'll accept it. X-Factor was fun, crossovers, the Fall of the Mutants and the Morlocks. So there were always bright crossovers you could look forward to. But eventually in the 90s, I just dropped. I didn't pick up again really until Grant Morrison did his spectacular run. And since then, I've kind of, it's hit or miss. I bought X-Men Red, Blue, Gold. I've been definitely following Hickman. I always have a soft spot for X-Men. I do think a lot of the storylines that I absolutely love, House of M, brilliantly done. Age of Apocalypse. I mean, yeah, it's hard for me to go back and look at some of the artwork, but I just love that idea where all these characters went off to the edge, and I got excited when Cable accidentally stumbled into the, well, we call it the Franklin universe now, and people were becoming aware. And then, of course, Heroes Return. It was fun. It was exciting. People bought it. It drove sales. Like it, hate it now. At the time, it was big. And I was on board, and it was just a lot of fun. It's amazing, though. Like I said, I lucked out through reprints. I've been able to read almost everything of X-Men, including I got the Epic Collection where they deal with the X-Men appearances between the end of the original series, beginning of Giant Size.
That is such a fun Epic Collection.
That is great because it goes through all sorts of different books, puts together wildly different things. And it was just fun. And I'm looking forward to, I've got them all in Essentials. I will replace these with Epic Collections eventually because it's just fun reading. And I believe I have 1, 2, and 3 in omnibus form. So I'm pretty cool on that. So X-Men was definitely one of the top teams when I stopped, and it just edged out Monkey Men by that much. So that's my number two. Corey, what do you got for your next one on list, which I believe would be number four?
Yep, my number four is The Avengers. When The Avengers is done right, it is the center of the Marvel Universe because it's the big characters all are part of it. If you go back to when it started, it was they come together whenever it's a threat that individual heroes can't face. And you know, as a comic reader, it's, well, especially as a kid, it's, boy, I'd sure like to read Thor, Captain America, Iron Man, and some other stuff. Now, I could buy their individual books, but here's a book where they're all in it together. And in a lot of ways, that's what a super team was. When you're a kid, you know, your funds are limited. So that's how you look at things. But one of the things that I've always liked, Roy Thomas took over from Stan. Stan did an okay job on those early Avengers stories. It's kind of telling that Kirby left fairly early to do other things. But when Roy Thomas took over, he kind of kept it the same for a while. And then he decided this is going to be the core of the Marvel Universe. Kirby was creating stuff, but Roy was putting all the puzzle pieces together. Pretty soon, John Buscema took over the art, and Roy did the first big story that lasted a whole bunch of issues, the Kree-Skrull War, which when I was a kid was spoken of in the same breath as the Galactus trilogy. It was kind of the first big story where, oh man, Earth is really in trouble. The problem is, if you go back and read it now, Roy really didn't know how to end the story, so he just kind of pulled a rabbit out of a hat. Steve Englehart used it to play with the Marvel Universe, play with all of the toys of the Marvel Universe, as did most of the readers after that. I'm sorry, most of the writers after that. I think by the 90s, the creative team lost that idea, which is why the Avengers kind of fell apart. Until Bendis came back and re-looked at the Avengers in a way a lot of people hadn't, where he said, well, back when it started, he put all of the biggest characters in it. Well, those aren't the biggest characters anymore. I'm going to put the biggest characters in it. And they come together to face the big things. And all of the big crossovers would spin out of it because this is the Avengers. They're the core of the Marvel Universe. And it's one of the things where I like reading it because of that. I like when creators felt that way. And I think one of the things Marvel has to kind of keep in mind is knowing what each book is. And for the most part, editorial does. You know, even now with Jason Aaron on the Avengers, he is dealing with the big stuff. The celestial at the core of the Earth, the Avengers of a million BC. There's going to be an Avengers Forever, which is a multiversal group of Avengers. Really just kind of, this is the core of the Marvel Universe. This is where all the big stuff happens. And it's one of my favorite books for that reason. You've also had a lot of artists who've come on and really done their best work. George Perez, John Buscema had two runs on the book, both of which were just phenomenal. Even John Byrne's stuff. I like his art on the Avengers more than I like his art on the X-Men. And I really can't explain why. I just think that he did a better job on the Avengers. And I think part of it was John Byrne really likes the characters from the 60s. We won't talk about his run on Avengers West Coast. No. But that's my number four book. Joe, what's next on your list?
Tim from Granite City just sent me some photos of his stuff, and it looks like not pretty. Anyways, I'm going to piggyback. Lots of warped books due to lack of box strength. So you're getting that. You're going to get this a week after we're getting text from Tim live as he's unboxing his stuff. I'm going to continue on with the Avenger things. Same thing. I've tried reading the early Avengers via my Essentials, and while the early first couple issues are fun because it's a big group, Captain America shows up. It kind of, when they get down to just the four, I kind of lose interest, and I've tried to wade through it. I got up to where Giant Man joins again. My first Avenger was the infamous Avengers number 200. Ooh. Jim Shooter, George Perez, Bob Layton, David, how do you say his name? Micheliney.
Rhymes with pickle my knee.
Now, when I read it, again, this is 1980. I'm in my golden age youth of comics. I was like, oh, this is so good because it had everybody in it. It was an oversized issue. It had that big banner on the top. You could win a Toys R Us shopping spree. We didn't have a Toys R Us in Minnesota yet, but, you know, whatever. You know, and of course, I was 12 years old. I didn't realize, you know, even I thought he used his machine to push her into falling in love with her. And my assumption is she heard that and was okay with it. But later on, when they wrote Avengers Annual 10, I think it was, wasn't it? When they revisited this issue, she obviously was still under the influence of the machine. Because I was kind of like, you know, she made her choice to go with him. But, you know, and now you realize, yeah, he just used the machine to rape her and, you know, have her way with him and whatever. But so that started me off on my run of Avengers. And of course, let's see, 201 came along with Ultron, Crawlers. They fought Yellow Claw. And then I think Shooter started writing it. And that was, of course, the whole I hit my wife once, therefore I'm a wife beater for all time bullshit. It got weak because they were, you know, we only got four members, but then 221 came along with the big Avenger drive, which was just a lot of fun. And I enjoyed
That's when Roger Stern started writing it.
Yeah, he was on board with that. And I enjoyed Roger Stern run. I think I'm trying to get, what was the last issue? I can't find the last issue I read, but I was in it for the long haul. I absolutely adored Kurt Busiek's Avengers because he did kind of like what you were talking, Corey. It was the core of the universe. I mean, it started out with George Perez's artwork. And in the back, he did references as to where all these people came from. You know, Ultron's, we would have words with the, why that wasn't in the second Avenger movie, I have no idea. The crossover with the Thunderbolts, I followed all the way through till Kurt left. And when Geoff Johns took on, I kind of aborted because it just didn't hold me. No, maybe I should revisit those, but they just didn't do it to me. I jumped back on board when Bendis took over. I did follow the Disassembled. So I was aware what was going on there, but the new Avengers were just brilliant. I didn't pick up everything. I mean, I picked up new Avengers. I picked up Avengers. I didn't pick up Dark Avengers. Now I realize I should have. I didn't pick up Mighty Avengers. I realize I should have. It was just flowing from one storyline to the other. Even going back now, you realize, oh, yeah, they had the Secret Empire laid out in New Avengers. So they knew where they were going. The current run is not as, it's not holding me as much, but I'm still sticking with it just because they do have some fun ideas. But at 50, I may bail. Oh, who am I kidding? If Marvel doesn't, you know, keep shipping me, you know, comics that look like they were not only with the Farm Marvel crease, but then the Penguin crease and the UPS crease and the Bad Box crease. I may stick with Avengers just because a lot of story and it does feel like massive things are going on. I'm an Avenger fan. I got a lot of Avengers, though, I have not read. You know, I did read the paperback with the Avenger Kree War. I did read the Korvac saga. I picked up bits and pieces here and there, like when Red Ronin, the robot from Godzilla, was finally disposed of. I've loved the Avengers. Close but no cigar were the Defenders for me, but Avengers topped it just because, you know, they felt more relevant, like everything was going on. And like I said, I started with big storylines going on with awesome prez art. And so you got that lot to live up for if you think you're going to take on the Avengers. So that was my pick as well. Corey, well, how about you? What else you got on your list of stuff?
My number three is the X-Men. Yes, the X-Men have gone through a lot of ups and downs over the years. But when I started reading comics in 1975, I read, you know, everything when I was a kid. But I didn't read superhero books till 75 because the art was dark. And I was a very sensitive kid. And I would look at it and go, no, those are scary. But I finally started reading superhero comics in 75. And that Christmas, I fell down a flight of stairs face first and broke my jaw, ended up in the hospital. Over Christmas break, had to get my jaw wired shut, and my uncle brought me a bunch of comics, one of which was Giant Size X-Men number 2. And before you go, oh man, you missed it by one. No, that was Roy Thomas and Neil Adams doing the Sentinel story. Oh my God, this is the greatest comic ever. So the next time I got to go buy comics, I went to, you know, I was at the grocery store with my friend Pat Humphrey, and there was the spinner rack, and oh, look, there's the X-Men. And oh, they're fighting all these new people. I don't know who they are. X-Men 100. And I'm reading X-Men 100, and all of a sudden, Wolverine kills Jean Grey. Oh, wait, no, it was a robot. The X-Men I knew are all Sentinels. X-Men was bi-monthly. So I was hooked. I had to know who these new characters were. I had to know what all was going on. Dave Cockrum was being inked by Frank Chiamatti, looking very Neil Adams-y. And I just, by three issues in, by X-Men 103, is this is the greatest comic book of all time. And I love the X-Men. I would say I started to lose that love a little after issue 200 because the art wasn't as clean as it was. You started getting that Mark Silvestri really scratchy stuff where all the faces looked the same. And one thing that really bugged me was the figures were all shown very small so that they could fit everybody into all the pages. And the stories got more and more convoluted. I have gone back and forth. There are times when I really love the X-Men, Grant Morrison writing it, Ed Brubaker writing it, Jonathan Hickman writing it. There are times when it's kind of eh. But I always go back to those Claremont issues when Claremont was at his peak. And when you go back and read them now, they seem overwritten and full of angst. And as you said, he's throwing stuff out there that he may or may not pick up later. But he actually kind of brought Marvel out of being a bunch of most books at Marvel when he started writing, everybody was writing like they were Stan Lee. And he sort of brought it out of that into writers having their own voice. You did have other writers at the time like Steve Gerber and Doug Mensch, but they all kind of had Stan Lee in their DNA. And Chris Claremont had science fiction novels and fantasy novels in his DNA. So the books, even the superhero books he did, felt different, and that translated onto the page. And it's why the X-Men, in my mind, is my third favorite superhero team. Joe?
For me, one that I'm very disappointed nobody's doing anything with. I know they've tried, but I have a soft spot for Wildcats. That's Wild Covert Action Teams. This, of course, originally was part of Image Comics. It appeared August 1992, and it was published by Image Comics, Jim Lee's first published work under Image. And eventually, in 1998, he sold Wildcats and everything to DC Comics, and they really haven't done much of anything. First of all, Jim Lee's art was amazing. It was fun to watch, fun to look at. He drew beautiful women. He drew impossibly muscle-bound men. The initial story arc had Voodoo going to the team. She was our point of view as characters such as Hellspont, Daemonite Warlord had taken control over the Vice President Dan Quayle. And we met the different characters over the time of the series. We finally went out and we discovered more about them. I absolutely love Grifter. I thought it was a brilliant costume. I like the fact he had history with why can't I think of her name? The hot whitehead, not a redhead, but she was wearing
was it Zealot?
Zealot, that's who it was. I was looking for her name here on the YouTubes. And of course then you had Spartan, Void, He brought in names. He brought in Travis Jerez, Chris Claremont, James Robinson, Alan Moore to work with it. By the time it got to DC, they came out with a Wildcats version 3.0, which revolved around the Halo Corporation and its CEO, Jackie Marlowe, doing things to better the world. And it was 24 issues that were just fun and mind-boggling, but I can see why they didn't go so well, because you had to kind of think about it. When they tried another series in the DC Universe, the New 52, it just kind of flip-flopped. Even Grant Morrison's writing couldn't quite, I think they did like one issue. That was it. That was like back in the 2006. And I don't think it's just not something that seems to be something that readers nowadays care about. But the earlier issues out of all the Image books, you know, I thought it was just fun. It was interesting the way these characters interacted. I liked the way they were drawn. Possibly because, like I said, I just was wowed by Jim Lee's art, especially knowing, you know, he came from X-Men to whatever. He did team up with other characters. I mean, we did see a Wildcats Spawn crossover that I believe Alan Moore wrote. Well, you know, Youngblood showed up, so it was good to see Jim Lee penciling Youngblood. I don't know. I'll throw this out to you, Corey. Do you think a lot of the stuff Jim Lee brought to DC, you think it's just nobody cares? Because we just want to see our old friends, Batman, Superman, Justice League, going, and we don't really care how they reboot Wildcats.
I think when he brought those characters to DC, you have to remember there was a time when The Authority, huge seller. Other Wildstorm books, huge sellers. But then a lot of the big names went over to Marvel or went over to Image or went somewhere else, and they got replaced by people who weren't as well known, didn't have as distinctive an art style. And Jim Lee was busy with the corporate stuff because he got moved into corporate really fast.
Oh, yeah.
And it was, well, we could put Jim Lee back on Wildcats, or we could have him draw a year of Batman. And then have him draw a year of Superman.
If well, you're even DC, back in Image, you know, he was busy. He came up with Gen 13, Deathblow, yeah. Stormwatch, crossed over with Bad Rock, She, The Mask.
But he was always doing stuff.
No, he didn't. He was busy running things in the background, you know, keeping
his little studio. And he would direct the studio. And then at DC, they kind of used that. He was the head of the West Coast and everything. But I think the characters themselves, they aren't as iconic. They're very, very much a product of their time. Go back and read Gen 13 now, and it's so 90s. You would have to completely revamp everything about those characters for them to work today, because they're very much 90s stereotypes. And it's a lot like if you did a comic about hippies in the 60s and then tried to reboot it in the 90s.
Are you saying we're not going to see a Brother Power the Geek remake, reboot, well, revamp?
We did.
Oh, okay.
Under Vertigo.
Yeah.
But they've tried it a few times. And the last time they tried it with Warren Ellis, and again, I don't think there's enough there for those characters. You really have to have people who are big name creators to draw readers, because, hey, want to buy a grifter comic? Who's that? Huh? Without a big name attached to it, nobody's going to care.
Too bad.
My number two, Fantastic Four. The people don't think of the Fantastic Four as a superhero team book, oddly. Because when you mention best team books, they don't mention the Fantastic Four. And I think it's because the Fantastic Four are not your typical superhero team. They are a family. Reed Richards is the dad. Sue Richards is the mom. Human Torch, while he's Sue Richards' younger brother, is like the kid brother. The Thing is the grumpy uncle. There was a time when the Thing was the most popular character at Marvel, and people tend to forget that. In the 70s and into the 80s, the Thing was the most popular character at Marvel behind Spider-Man. And when you thought, what is your typical Marvel character? It was the Thing, because he was he had the tragic story. And one person who reviewed comics back then said that he embodies the constant belly aching that is Marvel superheroes. Oh, I can't. I'm trapped. I'm a monster and nobody loves me. Meanwhile, you know, he's beloved by everybody in the Marvel universe, but he still had that core of tragedy. Like a lot of characters, the Fantastic Four went through ups and downs. But at their core, the Fantastic Four is what probably my favorite Marvel team. Because there were a lot of stuff started. Kirby threw all that stuff into the mix. And the family dynamic is different from a superhero team dynamic. The Avengers are co-workers. They may really like each other, but they're co-workers. Even in the third Thor movie, when Thor is in the Gladiator arena and Hulk comes out, hey, I know him from work.
Well, and the Avengers were interesting because they kept their secrets. Justice League was kind of interesting because they seemed like they were friends. They knew each other's identity. At least in the beginning, they did.
And the Fantastic Four, they're a family. They do superhero-ish stuff, but a lot of times they're more the explorers, the scientists. And Dan Slott has really figured out how to do that in the modern superhero era very, very well. But also, when people come onto the Fantastic Four, aside from the 90s, they are trying to do their best work. They want to live up to Stan Lee and Jack Kirby. And I think at its core, when people go back to that, they go back to the family dynamic. They go back to the fact that these are explorers who just kind of tumble into adventures because Reed drags them there. They're at their most entertaining. They're at their most relatable. And it really works as a superhero team because the dynamic they have is very simple. It's relatable. It's understandable. And it's good for inter-team conflict that you know isn't going to destroy the book. I think there was one time in the history of my buying comics where I tapped out on the Fantastic Four, and that was in the 90s when Reed Richards was dead. Sue Richards was dressing like an Image character. The Thing had been disfigured by Wolverine. And the book was just a mess. And stories just went on and on and on without a hope of them ever ending and getting more and more convoluted because everybody looked at the X-Men and rather than, oh, they do complex character work, they went, oh, well, the stories are really convoluted and don't make a lot of sense. So if we want our book to sell as well as the X-Men, we better do that. Thankfully, they came back. Chris Claremont's run on the Fantastic Four, I think, is really underrated because he delved into the family dynamic better than a lot of writers do and kind of put the book back on track. And then you had Mark Waid's run, which was amazing. Mark Miller's run didn't quite fit. But then after that, you got Matt Fraction, you got Jonathan Hickman, and now you've got Dan Slott. Fantastic Four is just one of my favorite books. And now, Joe, what's your number one?
My number one is Legion of Superheroes. And I will, as I always do, talk about when I started it. And it was, of course, Legion of Superheroes 290, The Great Darkness Saga. Paul Levitz, Keith Giffen, we're doing it. it just had a lot of buzz going on it, and I lucked out and was able to pick it up. I actually think I picked up Annual 1 because it came out. And again, this is like 1982, and I'm just trying to – I knew who the Invisible Kid was. I knew who Computo was. I knew all these things. I just wish I knew why, because I wasn't reading a lot of Legion of Superheroes. I think I had tried it, you know, when it was Superboy in the Legion of Superheroes. And then when Superboy left, I tried it again. But it just didn't hold with me. But then the Great Darkness Saga came, and with Paul Levitz and Keith doing it, I was on board. I was able to pick up the back issues, go far enough back to see what the storyline was in the beginning. And even, you know, 281 was kind of fun because Steve Ditko did the art, which was really neat. Going forward, I hung with it. I went through Crisis. There was a lot of intensity with it. Like some of my faves, I'm just looking through the list, like issue 300, which was amazing. Tales of the Adult Legion with all the throwbacks with Kurt Swan, Dave Cockrum, James Sherman. They did kind of the same thing with Justice League 200, where they had a bunch of throwbacks, bringing back people who had worked on these characters previously as they split off in their teams, and the new Justice League had to face the off against the old Justice League. They did that split book thing where Legion of Superheroes became, what did they call it? Baxter?
Yep, they were the Baxter books. And then a year later, they would be reprinted as Tales of on Mando paper, which was like one step up from the newsprint. And it's weird how in the 90s we knew all these paper grades.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm sorry, in the 80s. Yep, so, yep. Well, this is a Baxter book, so it's going to cost more. The Mando books. And then remember when DC went all Mando, and mm-hmm. they went to all 75 cents, and Marvel were all 60 cents. And immediately people were writing Marvel saying, hey, your books look like crap.
What I love about the Legion of this era was the interpersonal relationships with everybody. You know, Firestorm wanted Dawnstar, but he was all energy, so he couldn't do anything about it. There was a time when I think Invisible Lad had to destroy the suit, and then Wildstorm refuses to get in his suit and just haunted him over a couple issues. Even in the 300, you don't see Wildstorm in his suit. You see him just hovering as a ball of energy. You knew about Lightning Lad and Saturn Girl. You knew about Bouncing Boy and Duplicate Lad. Well, I knew that because of Fred Hembeck.
Duo Damsel.
You know. Duo Damsel. Yeah. People died. I knew about Feral Lad. I knew about when she was Triplicate Girl. There were consequences going on. It was a big deal when Superboy came to the future, when they called Supergirl forward. I knew about the supervillains when they showed up. I knew about Mordo. It was just an amazing continuity. After Crisis, there was the issue number 16, and I think this is of what's considered the third series, the Baxter series, where Brainiac was just a mess. And then, of course, Sensor Girl showed up, who I guess was supposed to be Supergirl until somebody came down and said no, and that was a big mystery. Time Trapper did his razzle-dazzle killing Superboy with lead Polar Boy to utter words that chill me to this day. One day we're going to make Time Trapper pay, and then we'll see if a Time Lord can die. Just amazing. And, of course, they ended it. They started up 5 years later. Other than Death appearing as the Earth blew up, I kind of lost it there. I really, you know, I enjoyed Legionnaires. I enjoyed the third make. For me, the finale of all this was during Final Crisis, Legends of Three Worlds, with Jeff Johns and George Perez doing it, where they brought together all the, I mean, I have this as a standalone book. I have the original miniseries. It's just a phenomenal book. Bendis has tried to bring the Legion out. I don't know if he's in a planned pause or if it's a COVID pause. I was enjoying the book. I know a lot of long-term guys were, I don't like it. I don't like Bendis. He can write his way out of a paper bag. Whatever. I don't mind that you say you don't like it, but, you know, that's your problem. I mean, I hope DC can get it together and try to do a Legion book. But the problem with Legion is that it's always tied to 20th century continuity. When Levitz was doing it, it wasn't. They were their own thing. They had their own world going out there. They would throw out tidbits. There's a reason why we don't allow Green Lanterns on Earth. You can look it up. We find out much later what it was. They weren't 100% tied into 20th century. And I think that's a valid complaint about anybody who's writing it, is they feel compelled to always tie it somehow into the 20th century. And I think Bendis did a fun thing, you know, where he brought Jonathan Kent forward, and he naturally thought, I should bring Damian forward. He'd get a kick out of this. Oh my gosh, you can't do this. And then the Legion's now in trouble because they're mucking around with time, unauthorized. I don't know if I need Legion to be rebels against the planets. I kind of like them better as they were actual kind of sanctioned Parshan people of the United Planets. There's a rich history, a rich mythology. I fear anybody who does it is just, okay, we're going to follow along, and he's just going to remake, reboot everything. And I guess I can understand the anger about that. But those earlier issues of Legion, man, if they did an omnibus of those, please don't tell me they did, I would pick that up, because that was Levis's run was amazingly fun. I know if I got together the 5 year later stuff, he apparently did some groundbreaking stuff. I read it in back issue, which I think is probably good enough for me, because as I was reading it, it was really disjointed. It wasn't the straightforward superhero story. It was like, okay, something's happened. We got to figure out who it was. Plus the art was kind of goofy. It made it real hard to figure out who was who. I wasn't always sure who was who. Yeah, sure, the green guy's Brainiac, but like I said, Legionnaires was fun. I enjoyed that. I forget what the third one of that, the third crisis, but it doesn't matter. It's all out there. Not terribly expensive unless you're going into like first appearances and things like that. And I'd like to see what DC comes up with it, but I suppose unless they put Batman in it, no one's going to care. Corey, what's your grand finale here?
This is not a team that when I was a teenager or even in my 20s, I would have said was my number one team. But now it is, and it's the Justice Society of America. This is the original superhero team. Marvel had the All-Winners Squad, but if you go back and read All-Winners comics, they really didn't become a team till after World War II. A lot of Roy Thomas's stuff about the Invaders is retroactive continuity. The Justice Society was the first superhero team. I have read all of the Justice Society stuff from the 40s because they reprinted it all in the 90s in the DC archives. And what it was, the team would kind of get together and they would talk about their adventures. And then you would get an adventure of each of the characters drawn by their regular team. All of them were written by Gardner Fox back then, but it would be, you know, the guy who drew Hawkman would draw the Hawkman chapter. The person who drew the Wonder Woman would draw the Wonder Woman chapter, until you got later on when DC Comics went from 64 pages to 56 pages. So, oh, the stories are going to be shorter. We're not going to have as much time. They finally had them doing stuff together. One of the early books when I started reading at DC was All-Star Squadron by Roy Thomas, which, boy, he sure liked that a lot better than he did the Invaders. And now that I've read so much of Roy Thomas's stuff in Alter Ego, he was a Justice Society fan. And the All-Star Squadron was, you know, the Justice Society, basically. It's the Justice Society during World War II. Then the Justice Society was written out of DC. They came back, were written out, came back, were written out. And then Geoff Johns picked it up and did his best work because he figured out what DC should be. It's tied to the past, but in the present. You know, there are characters who, okay, they're from World War II, but they're still alive and vital through various means. Others have passed on their mantle to others. He kind of made it that the Justice Society and not the Justice League is the core of the DC universe back when it was just all one universe. And he would have the big things going on there. And I think it's because Geoff Johns writes big things. When he was writing Green Lantern, you look back on his run on Green Lantern, and boy, he added enormous amounts of stuff to DC that they will be mining for decades to come. A lot like Kirby, where Kirby would tell these stories, and then everybody at DC wanted to play with his toys. But the Justice Society is that longevity. It's the past. It's a second and third generation. And when they are done well, it's my just so good. Even the stuff that didn't sell, the 10 issues by Straczynski and Paraback. Oh, I love those books. Even the stuff in the 70s where Paul Levitz kind of brought them back. And while it's very 70s, and you could tell that Wally Wood just did not give a shit about what he was drawing, other than Power Girl's chest, there is a history to it. Have they always had good stories? No. The Death of Batman story is one of the worst stories ever in comics, okay? Flat out, terrible. Hated it so much. But the Justice Society is a team. Kind of, they're the first superhero team. And in my mind, they should be the best, but they are my favorite. Speaking of who's the best, Joe, do you know who's the best at keeping you safe on the internet?
Well, it ain't Facebook. Well, unless I go down.
No, it's NordVPN, and they're one of our sponsors. Our newest sponsor is NordVPN. Let's be honest, if you're out on the internet, you need a VPN to protect you. There's all sorts of things going on the internet where people can track you. You could accidentally download a keylogger, all sorts of things. NordVPN gives the best security possible. It has a password manager, which generates complex passwords, syncs across all your devices, stores your notes and credit card information. It also gives you 10 gigabytes of private cloud storage, secure files that backs up your data automatically. But the main thing it gives you is peace of mind. It gives you peace of mind when you're out on the internet, when you're streaming, when you're playing games, when you're listening to podcasts like this one. It gives you safety anywhere at any time. It protects your online activity. You get full access to all content. And if you use the link go.nordvpn.net/3ku, it'll take you to where you can get a great deal for a 1-month plan, a 2-year plan, a 1-year plan. They are our newest sponsor. We're happy to have them. And if you would like to sponsor something here at any of the podcasts on the Solitaire Rose Network, you can. Just email me, solitairerosenetwork@gmail.com. Thanks. And boy, this episode's got a long time. You'd think that, Corey, he doesn't have anything further to say about stuff. No, I do, and I do all these podcasts about it. The Solitaire Rose Radio Network is currently on a pause, basically because COVID-19 has made it so that I have to work a lot of extra hours at both jobs. But you can still go and listen to my other podcasts. Now, you're probably listening to Crazy Comics and Stories, which is the main podcast, but on this same feed, KRAYZCOMIX, is Solitaire Rose Radio, the solo radio podcast that I do. I've done interviews, I've done short stories, I've done all sorts of things, and you can get to it right here on this same feed. I also do a podcast called Novelcast, where I take the novels I've written and turn them into free audiobooks. That's over at novels.solitairerose.com. Dangerous Dan Moore and I, and of course Wolfie B. Bad, give you bad advice over at badadvice.solitairerose.com. You send in your questions, and we give you the aforementioned bad advice. And then myself and Adam Vermillion from For the Love of Comics do the Fantastic Forecast at fantasticforecast.solitairerose.com, where we go through the issues of the Fantastic Four, four issues at a time, to give the plot and commentary on each issue. That's not all. Yes, I'm crazy. I still, over at PWInsiderElite.com, every week on Wednesday, do a recap of the latest episode of AEW Dynamite. I write up what happened, and then myself and Anthony Pyrus will do an audio. Now, you can only listen to the audio if you're a member at PWInsiderElite.com, and if you're a wrestling fan, you should be, where we then break down the episode, talk about what we liked, what we didn't like, give it a grade, and let you know if you should have watched that episode. Those are the other podcasts here at the Solitaire Rose Radio Network. Thanks. And now we get to Joe's favorite part of the show.
Gargling Gershwin?
No. It's Joe. What's going on the eBays?
Oh, you know, it's kind of slowed down a little bit. And, you know, you always wonder if it's because, you know, I did a kind of a purge of things, because with postal rates going up, all of a sudden selling a $4 comic and shipping it for, you know, $4.50 doesn't quite make a lot of sense. But, you know, there's a few things selling. I mean, just look at the last 10. I sold Star Blazers, $21.99 Volume 3 Blu-ray Limited Edition. When they first came out, they numbered them. I have it all in non-limited edition, but, you know, I'd wanted to buy all 7 volumes, and I got the first 3 through Discount Comic Book Service. After that, they stopped carrying them. Sold a good condition of Binky 76 from 1971. That was a DC comic trying to do their Archie impersonation. For the MCBA boys, I sold the Before Watchmen Night Owl number 1 Jim Lee variant cover. Speaking of, what is Jim Lee up to now? This one actually went overseas, so and a guy made an offer, and I took it. A couple of variant covers, My Little Pony Micro Series Pinkie Pie number 5, the variant cover from Source Comics and Games. Only have one left. Well, I have one autograph, too, that my daughter gave me, didn't want. I don't remember this one. It was a milk giveaway that came with coupons. Magazine size Adventures with the DC Superheroes.
Oh, I thought it was a milk giveaway, and that Milk from Milk and Cheese got his own book.
It could be. You should be. But this was a free magazine that it was a $3.95 value that you got free with a purchase of 2 gallons of milk. And inside were over $100 in valuable coupons, which could explain why it's so expensive. But let's see, some other things. I sold a graphic novel, Evolution, The Story of Life on Earth, by Jay Hosler and Kevin and Xander Cannon, names we've talked about before. Roman Dirge, Lenore Cootie's Book 3 hardcover. These are ones my daughter gave me before she moved out. Some signed stuff. I had a Batman 50 signed by Jay Lee, his variant cover where Catwoman was about to use the whip on a newly married Batman. I had a signed copy of a magazine-sized book called Cerebus Readers in Crisis. I think I've talked about this way in the past, but what they did is when the first magazine came out, a certain amount were actually signed and ready to go. This one got signed by, Steve Peters, Max Inc. There was a Tipton sheet by Dave Sims, Elizabeth Bartowell, all the people that had worked on it. These were actually printed by Ink Images, and inside would have all sorts of articles about Cerebus and the readers and stuff. And like I said, this was just a rare, I don't remember how I picked it up, the signed one. A couple other things I'll point out, and then I'll tell you what to do. Corey, do you remember the first appearance of Oh, what was that guy? The future Batman, Timothy Fox?
Yes.
I actually discovered I had a Whitman logo variant of it.
Ooh.
Only in very good shape. Went for a measly $80. And the only reason I didn't mention it last time is because by the time I got it up, it sold like within 10 minutes. And I'm thinking, maybe I should have sold it for $100. Oh, well. Sell them fairly, grade them fairly. That's really all you got to do. Even though sometimes you will grade something, people don't always read it. I've talked about in Freaking how my copy of Nice House on the Lake, number one, came, my first printing, and the back
yes.
looked like it was waterlogged. So I sold it on the eBay. It's about a third of what it's going for. And I wrote, not near mint, VG, very good. Book has water wrinkles on the back cover. Sadly, I got it this way. Good reading copy. A few people asked me questions. You know, I said, if you look, you really can't see it, but you could feel it. You could see the bottom cover is wrinkly. I wrote even in the description, this is for a very good water damage copy. The person who bought it asked, well, should have, you gave me positive feedback, but said should have added something. It was that something was spilled on it in the description. And again, I don't know if they're being facetious or not, but I wrote, no one would read that in any part of any description, any part of any eBay listing anyways. So, live and learn. But like I said, I think they're just being silly about it. You can go see what I put on. I've put on dozens of things, not only things that I have, but the MCBA has given me the okay to put stuff up from the charity booth. So I'm not to mention which ones are charity booth. Like I said, the Before Watchmen Night Owl. I'll give you a hint. They're probably the very expensive variants, the hidden gem variants, where they like pull out some art they've never used before from Sal Buscema or Jack Kirby or whatever. I got a lot of them. I'm putting them up online. I always price the cheapest that I can on the eBay. So if somebody's got $120, I'll be the guy selling it. Well, it might be $119.99, could be $99.99. But you know what you can do. Just like the guy who bought the Before Watchmen or a few of the other ones, the adventure with DC superheroes I talked about. Make an offer. You know what to do. And let me know you listen to this here podcast, because I got tons of stuff that now is no longer feasible to put on eBay. I'll give it as a bonus to you. I mean, I can't give away keys to the Stroll compound. It's not as much fun now that Corey's there 24/7. But you know where to go. Crazy, K-R-A-Y-Z. Come get some.
And now we get to my favorite part of the show. No, not where I brag that I'm going to be getting a press pass to the AEW pay-per-view Full Gear when it's here in Minneapolis. No, it's Freaking and Geeking Joe. What are you freaking about?
I like Babylon 5. And it was a geeking where the creator of Babylon 5, J. Michael Straczynski, is doing a reboot. He's not doing a continuation. He's not doing anything else because six of the main actors have passed away, including key actors. At least three of them. Actually, all of the key ones. And I'm not going to list off the names, but, you know, it's just not feasible to do a continuation or, a next generation or whatever. He only said, Straczynski, that is, he would come back if he got complete control without interference, because he still has a bad taste in his mouth what happened with Crusade. Google it if you care. I'm not getting into it. However, Babylon 5 fandom, who has been cocky up to this time because they were always like, oh, look at Star Trek, argue about how crappy Discovery is, and they ruined Star Trek, and they should go back to Next Generation, or Star Wars, and how Solo was an abomination, and the Force Awakens movies never should have happened, and Rey's were too powerful in the Force, and blah, blah, blah. We'll never do that.
I bet they are.
Oh, you know they are, to the point where it's just, I mean, and it's the same thing you and I talked about podcasts ago. How can you not like something that ain't out yet? How can you not like something that the original creator is working on? Say what you will, Roddenberry really didn't have, we had sway, but he didn't really have a lot of sway in Next Generation.
He did the first season.
Not as much as you'd think. I mean, he's...
If you read David Gerrold's stuff, he talks about how a lot of the problems they had were Gene Roddenberry throwing his weight around and changing his mind about things over and over and over and over. Yeah. It would be, this is okay in this episode. And then a couple episodes later, you'd have something similar. And he'd, no, it's not allowed.
Yeah. And so, you know, the first season,
they were cobbling together old scripts from
Phase 2
because of the writer's strike.
Yeah, it was tough. The characters were hard to get together. But yeah, the B5 universe is just going nuts. I mean, it's almost the closest I should have guessed is the one thing interesting about Babylon 5 is that most of the books and comics are canon. This is said by J. Michael Straczynski. Yet you get dweebs. I don't know what to call them. Nope, not canon. Books are not canon. The creators said they were. These ain't like Star Trek and Star Wars where they just banged out books. Or even like in Battlestar Galactica where they, Richard Hatch came out with his whole series of books, which, you know, in my mind should have been a Battlestar Galactica. And of course, Battlestar Galactica is the heavyweight in the room because everybody's like, oh, I haven't read a good reboot. Well, Battlestar Galactica, like it or love it, was a successful reboot of an old franchise that, you know, is well remembered but kind of sputtered. I've got the DVD of both on my shelf. I can watch them anytime I want. But some of these B5 guys, the butthurt that they're coming up with is like, oh, yeah, Straczynski's personally coming to your house to snap your DVD collection in half. They're going to block all streaming and summarily execute anybody who even says anything about the original. I'm excited. I'm like, oh, this is going to be fun. And Straczynski said point blank, I cannot do a continuation because the people I want to do it with have gone beyond the rim and stubbornly refuse to come back. I'm paraphrasing, of course. The people who are alive, he's in contact with because he might have guest appearances. I mean, I don't know if you ever watched Lost in Space that Netflix did. Bill Murray was in the first episode,
yeah,
which was fun. I mean, just he's not going to be a big part of it, but it was a nice nod. So I was it made it so the Babylon 5 board was just obnoxious. And the last thing I posted was my favorite meme from Young Frankenstein, when Gene Wilder, after reading all night his grandfather's work, realizes he could make a Frankenstein monster, and he looks up at the camera and goes, it could work! And then the lightning flashes, and I just wrote, here's the last word on a Babylon. One more word on the Babylon 5 reboot. It could work! And even then, people are like, nah, I don't think it's going to work. It's, wow. Just wow, B5 fans. You're as dumb as every other fandom.
You know what the worst thing about it is? When I first got online, back in the 80s, first thing I did was look for people to talk comics about. And this was right after Crisis on Infinite Earths. So there were people who, DC is worthless now. I can't read it because of Crisis. Everything after Crisis has been terrible. Blah, 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 blah. If you talk to fans now, they look upon those books after Crisis on Infinite Earths, most of them as their favorite DC books. But the people who complained about it were older fans who they were few and far between. And most of the people who were talking about comics were talking about how much they loved it. The thing I remember most is you could tell when a new issue of Justice League, the DeMatteis, Keith Giffen, Kevin Maguire book came out, because, you know, you would go from 5 or 6 messages a day to, oh, here's 70 messages. And they're all, oh, God, this is so great.
You know, Corey, you and I got to be an anomaly because, you know, if we see a book we don't like, we don't really bitch about it. And whereas some guys, like even my old partner, Pat, he's just like, I don't buy comic no more. I didn't own nothing this month. You know, he'll buy old stuff. I'm constantly digging up new stuff. I mean, I always complain about that. In the, well, I don't complain about it, but when I do the previews episode, I tell you, I list everything that caught my eye. I can't afford to buy it all. And if I don't like something, DC 52, Marvel with your damaged books, and you cause me not to want to buy your books, I'll find something else. That's just the way, you know, we got to be an anomaly in that. I don't know. Maybe you know more people like that, but maybe we just remember the bitches.
A lot of fans go online to complain about the stuff they like. And there, it's one thing to, when we do reviews, to go, I didn't care for this. Or when we do our freaking, this
is too many lines.
But like WWE, I have not enjoyed it for a while. I've just stopped watching. There's other wrestling I like.
And I'd rather watch AEW
or New Japan or MLW or Ring of Honor. Or more and more indies are putting their shows on. Like Mark Henry is running an indie out of Texas, which is, except for the fact that it looks terrible, it's his old friends from WWE and the new guys in the Texas area. It's just a fun indie who put together a show every so often. Find the stuff you like and praise it. I only have two freakings, by the way.
Well, I'm not done with my freaking yet. Oh, I know I've been off ranting. Yeah, no, perfect. I got to
be a 5-hour episode, isn't it?
It is, but I missed it. I probably had a reason for it. I'm not talking about the Hasbro toys. I mean, I think I mentioned that, you know, the Sentinel that was ordered a year ago for $500 came out, and oh my sweet bejesus, it looks beautiful. I did not buy the Galactus figure. I know I'm going to complain about it next year, but I missed two things that I really had my collector eye on. One of them was a book called B5 at 20, and I've got a copy of it. It was kind of a celebration of Babylon 5, but all the cast of 20 were still alive, and everybody signed everybody else's books. And Patricia Talman online had sold her copy for the charities that she worked with, and Bill Mummy had his copy online for $1,500. And I was eyeballing it, and I got a fresh brand new credit card, and I got, well, I got $500 cash. Just slowly build up. It sold. Son of a building block. You start thinking, oh man, I should have just put on the credit card, but you know, it's $1,500, but well, kudos for Patricia and, you know, thank you to Bill, and I missed it and whatever. But the one that really bothered me is, we talked about the King Spawn, Todd McFarlane signed one last podcast. There was one on the eBay, started at $500, which is actually pretty good because they're going anywhere from $700 to $1,200 raw, and then people are grading them and going over 2,000. And I thought, you know, I'll buy this. I'll sit on it, keep an eye on it. It went to 550, and you know, I just kept an eye on it. Finally, it was at $800, and I'm like, oh, it's way over what I want to spend on it. Plus, I could still, it's probably too late. I could probably run down to Nerding Out, buy theirs for $900. But you know, again, it's a lot of money, and at the time, I wasn't sure if the government was going to shut down. And you know, there's all sorts of just weird things in the economy. Guess how much it sold for, Corey?
$5,000.
Nope. You're about 10 off. $550.
Really?
Which means the spudhead who bid on it up to $800, they retract their bid at the last moment. And whoever bid $550 got it. I would have bought it for $550. I just figured at $800 with like 2 hours to go, it was out of my price range. I try to be positive about it. I mean, I didn't spend $2,000. And if a penny saves, a penny earned, I'm way ahead. Doesn't mean I ain't going to freak about it. Anyways, Corey, you had some freaking?
I only have two.
Ooh.
The first is, I read the last issue of Nick Spencer's Spider-Man. And Joe, have you read it yet? Issue 74.
I don't recall. Recap it briefly.
It is the end of his run and gives all the secrets about Kindred.
No, I have not gotten that yet. And judging by the way it's going, it'll probably be in like 400 pieces. So it'll be a jigsaw puzzle I can read.
As I read it, I felt like, wow, this thing is really rushed. Even though this is an extra size issue, it's all exposition theater. And there were so many things that were just crammed in there. It felt like, wow, this is the pacing is really bad. There's just too much going on. And he's trying to work it around a fight scene. I had to read it a second time because there's just so much being thrown at you. And the visuals don't correspond to what's being told in the story. And I have since found out that what it was, Nick Spencer's run was, in his head, was supposed to go longer. But Marvel said, no, you're wrapping it up with issue whatever. And they gave him the miniseries for the Sinister Six stuff that tied in and everything, but it was very much an editorial where you need to wrap this up and you need to wrap it up by this issue, and it was just all crammed in there, and I did not care for that. If you're gonna do something like that, you've got to give the writer more time or tell him, I know you want to do this Sinister Six stuff, you need to pull that out. I know you want to do this. You need to pull that out. You're going to focus on this one thing. Anything else, the toys you wanted to play with, I'm sorry, you're not going to get to play with these toys. Or pitch it as a mini series that we can do later. Because it's the last story he did was really hard to read. And there's a lot of stuff that's kind of left up in the air. Because it's so easy to tell he had stuff planned out a long time in advance, and instead he was told to wrap it up. I don't know why Spider-Man sales are still up or whatever, but it was just a very disappointing ending. And the one thing he did that I liked really kind of got lost in the fact that everything was crammed in so tight. And then the other one, Joe, you know how I said, gee, there doesn't seem to be any more issues of nonstop Spider-Man being solicited. I think it was just a miniseries. Well, nope, it was a regular series, but it's ending because the book is so very late that they're going to be doing a different series with a different artist, which means that nonstop Spider-Man number 5, the series ends on a cliffhanger. Ugh!
Boy, you there think they'd learn? Never, are they ever. Are they learning this from Archie Comics? I mean, what is going on around here?
They should never, ever, 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 ever end a series on a cliffhanger. Ever. It just should never happen anymore. It used to happen during the 70s because books would get canceled after they'd, you know, the book would get finished. They would get it ready for press and then, oh, it's canceled. Put an announcement in the letters pages. And sometimes the letters pages wouldn't even have that announcement. And then, okay, it's going to get wrapped up in 2-in-1, or it's going to get wrapped up in the Avengers, or it'll get wrapped up in Marvel Team Up, or, you know, wherever. But there's going to be another series to wrap it up. But now, oh, you pick up that nonstop Spider-Man trade paperback. Boy, that Chris Bacalo art is great. And then up, well, cliffhanger.
Hey, guess where my issues are going?
So, Joe, what are you geeking on?
I am absolutely in love with Star Trek Lower Decks.
Isn't it great?
Oh, my gosh. I knew about the series. People are raving about it. A week ago, actually, I should say maybe 5 days ago, I watched my first one, and I blew through 4 episodes in one sitting, and I just finished season 1, and as soon as we're done, I'll probably go watch another one. I love it. They're 24 minutes long. Obviously, they were made originally for commercial television, and I guess they farmed it out and finally found a home. First CBS Access, now Paramount Plus.
Well, here's the thing. CBS Access had commercials.
Ah, and I didn't pick it up until
Paramount Plus.
So that's
why it was structured that way. If you paid extra, you would get it without commercials.
Yeah, I did pay extra. That's why I never got it. Just a lot of fun, a lot of references. I watched it. I made the mistake of trying to have my wife watch it, seeing that she might like it. And of course, 10 minutes later, she wandered away. And I'm like, but I watched the whole first episode and realized I missed things the first time around. And the problem with streaming is you just can't stop and back at 10 seconds and catch it. You got to stop, wait 5 years to reload, and then continue going forward. And that's even with the improved interwebs. But yeah, absolutely loving it. Read one book from the Kickstarter world, Dredgestar Returns. This is Jim Starlin with Jamie Jameson. And this is Jim writing and drawing another brand new episode of Vanth Dredgestar. And this is basically a new chapter. It's complete in of itself, but we are introduced to a shadowy new threat that Starlin may have to deal with. All our old friends come back, some in forms you may not anticipate, some you may not remember. Fortunately, his omnibuses are available. And plus, on the inside, I got the tipped-in plate where Jim and Jamie autographed it. So just a lot of fun. I'm looking forward. I'll put that on my bookcase with all the other omnibuses. I haven't read it yet, but I'm going to. I picked up – I think I'm falling in love with those $10, $15, $20 of them. Things they're selling from Time Life, from Life, from People Magazine, where they have – a giant issue of stuff, reprinting all and some new stuff of articles. Could be Stan Lee, could be MASH. I picked up from the Archive of Prague and Classic Rock, Jethro Tull, the full story, 132 pages of Maximum Tull. And what was fun is that the first one I read was just they sat down with Ian Anderson and he went over the origins of Jethro Tull, where they how they all got together. And I've got a lot more to read. I love Jethro Tull, which will come into my next thing I'm geeking on. And I'll mention it from here to there, but we're doing a massive cleaning in my house. And folks, if you haven't cleaned your house because you've lived in it for God awful how long, you really need to think about it if you haven't, because it took us 5 hours to find, box, and move VHS CDs and LPs out of my house. I haven't even touched my DVDs. I probably won't. Some of it was just remembering things. You know, like I ran across a Kenny Loggins album, which I remember going with a friend of mine who passed away last year, Steve Anderson. And when we saw the concert, we're like, oh my God, we got to go get the album. Went to Kmart, which is where you went in the day. And they only had one. So we spent the rest of the day running Kmart to Kmart till we found a beloved second one. I had the infamous REO Speedwagon album, the number one that sold millions of copies. I was one of the millions. I allowed my daughter to look through them. I said, grab the albums you want because they're going in storage. It's not a big deal. You can go to storage. And they have to be like, hey, you got a Steve Martin album that's still bagged up. And it was his third one, Comedy's Not Pretty. Bought it, never listened to it. A lot of these albums I've replaced with CDs. I did go through my 45s. I got them all over there. So that was just a lot of fun, a lot of fun memories. I finally got all my records from my two comic shops in one area waiting to be basically destroyed. I've got, you know, credit card receipts with people's credit card numbers. I've got Z tapes from the cash register, tax stuff, credit card payouts, invoices from Cap City, Diamond, Heroes World, a ton of other minor distributors, utility bills, canceled checks. Some of them were kind of fun. Like I found one that my partner Pat wrote to Corey. Even then he was plotting against me. Bank records. I did try to pull out recyclable stuff. I mean, I like to use some of the one-sided paperwork as my junk paper when I'm printing labels and stuff. After a while, I just didn't care. Or if the paper was folded, I just, you know, you can't shove that in a printer. I got enough problems with my printer. As long as it didn't have personal identifying information on it, either mine or my employees or one of you, if you were my customers in the past. I took a picture of it. I shared it. I know with Corey, I don't think I put it on the general Facebooks, but it's done. And now I found a place where I'm just going to bring it in, box it in and bring it in and just have them shred it. It's amazing how 10 plus years of comics business can just be folded down into, you know, a couple bins full of papers. And again, this was back in the knuckle buster days, you know, chink chink, carbon copy everything. You get checks mailed out, returned. Nowadays, everything's electronic. So it would probably be just on electronic file till that aforementioned sunspot hits and wipes everything out. But that's pretty much it. So that is done and over with. Still got more to do, though. Oh, well. Corey, what you geeking on?
I have a new computer.
Well, good for you. What brand?
Yep. It is a Dell.
How swell.
It showed up, and today is the day that Windows 11 is released. This is a brand new computer that cost around $600. That's without a monitor. And I checked. Oh, no, the chip is not advanced enough for Windows 11. Right. Which is fine.
Until they decide to force you to download it.
Well, they can't because they run this thing. So I imagine by the time they discontinue Windows 10, usually they, like Windows XP was still in use up to a year ago, and that was over 15 years old. So computers don't last that long. It's nice and snappy. It runs everything really well, and we're recording on it.
Yay!
I was home Saturday night, and what I do on Saturday nights after when I'm getting ready for
bed. It's Corey's business. That's Corey's time.
Well, I set up my recordings on the DVR because Saturday night at like 11 p.m. is when they have Noir Alley on TCM. So I'm checking, and it's like, oh, what is this Cartoon Carnival? Oh, wow, it's a documentary about silent cartoons. Then after that, they had a documentary on the Fleischer Studio during the silent era. And then the second documentary on Fleischer Studio for the sound era. Those are so in my wheelhouse. It's like, oh, yeah. Oh yeah.
Even I'd be cool on that.
I'm about halfway through the Cartoon Carnival. The animation, the thing that, here's the weird thing about film history, Joe. No one knows what the first animated movie was, whether a short or a feature. Nobody knows. They have no idea because so many of them were just made locally. And movies were a disposable entertainment, like something like 95% of all silent films are just gone. So animation was such a weird little novelty. They didn't much pay attention to it. I always thought that it was, who's the
Ernie,
artist?
Ernie the Dinosaur.
Yeah, by the guy who did Little Nemo.
Yeah, even I remember that one.
It's not. It was by Winsor McKay, but no, there were animations before that. And the guy who did the first man in the moon, you know, we've all seen the picture of the moon and then the spaceship stuck in its eye.
Yeah, it was on Netflix for a while. I actually watched it. It was kind of fun.
He did a number of animated shorts. He was a magician. But after a while, he was so frustrated with the distribution and getting people to pay him that he just destroyed most of his movies. So we have no idea of any of that. But there were other artists, and it was part of a stage show. It would be a burlesque stage show where the artist would go up and he would draw, and then they would project a movie and he would, you know, interact with the drawing, much like Gertie the Dinosaur. Winsor McKay did that with Gertie the Dinosaur. But so much of this stuff we just don't know and may never know. I love that sort of thing. I'm a big film history buff. Speaking of videos.
Pop-up video.
There was a video that recently surfaced on YouTube that those of us in the comics history realm are passing around, and that is, it's a DVD extra on the making of Tales from the Crypt, the comic. It is a hour-long discussion between Al Feldstein, editor at EC, and Ray Bradbury. I'm going to put a link in the show description. It is amazing to watch. They get into their working relationship, why Ray Bradbury had to quit giving EC permission to do comics, Al Feldstein talking about working with him in the 50s, talking about the comic business the way Al Feldstein saw it, and Ray Bradbury talking about his love of comics. And something I did not know, Joe, have you ever read the book Something Wicked This Way Comes by Ray Bradbury?
I do not believe I have.
There was a short story called The Dark Carnival that Ray Bradbury sent to EC. EC did their version of it. And Al Feldstein is the one who talked Ray Bradbury into turning it into a novel, which then later was turned into the movie Something Wicked This Way Comes in the 80s by Disney. But they were trading ideas back and forth during the 50s. So many cool things in it. One thing is Al Feldstein, very, very political guy. I was on a discussion list with him. Very much an old school FDR liberal. And as he's talking with Ray Bradbury, it's 2002 when this is filmed, and we're going into the Gulf War. And Feldstein says, I don't understand it. I thought I raised these kids better. And he talks about how he used MAD, and all these kids who grew up reading MAD should know better than to start these wars and do this stuff, but they obviously didn't pay attention to him. And he doesn't understand why the hippies of the 60s became who they were later. And he just keeps going back to, I thought I taught them better than that. Just a really, really great video of two men who very instrumental in early comics. One of the Boom books that I liked that was canceled and then came out as a, they finished it up in a trade paperback because it's a young adult book, and boy, comic shop readers don't like buying young adult books as comics. The Avant-Garde, which is about a girls' basketball team at an art college. Third book came out. Very entertaining. You could tell when you read it that it was set up to be four issues of the comic. Go out of your way, even though it's a young adult book, very well done. Reminds me a lot of those coming of age stories like Hepcats or Nothing Better. There's this whole genre in comics of people who are doing comics about when they first go away to school. And this is a really good example of that. I also am all caught up on the Chip Zdarsky comic Stillwater, which threw a curveball twist that blew me away. I think I've talked about Stillwater in the past. What it is, it's this town where no one ages at all. And it's a horror comic, and it kind of goes from there. And I only want to tell you that because anything else I tell you is a spoiler. But with issue 9 and 10, they turn the entire concept on its head and really freaked me out at, one, how just creepy it is, and two, how it's, wow, he has no problem screwing with the world he's created. Which always makes me, which it reminds me a lot of Invincible, how every so often he would just pull the rug out from under the reader and you go, how the hell are they going to recover the series from that? And it was, oh no, they've just taken a bigger step. The thing is, with Stillwater, Chip Zdarsky says in the letters pages, he's making it up as he goes. He doesn't know where he's going with it. And that's what makes it even more fun. And the last thing I am geeking on, let's see if Joe remembers. Joe, do you remember the fifth week event called the Marvels Comic Group?
Was that when there was like an extra shipping date in the schedule? And since they didn't ship normal books, they would just ship one-shots and specials and stuff?
Yep.
And really, really late books.
Yep. Do you remember the Marvels Comics Group event they did? When I give you the premise, you'll remember it.
I was gonna say assistant editor month, but that was just in the normal books.
Nope. Marvel's comic group was, here's what the comics in the Marvel universe are like.
Oh, Yeah. I don't know what it was called, but I do remember the books where Spider-Man was some type of horror character and Fantastic Four was officially licensed. And I don't remember the full.
Yeah, and an X-Men book and a Daredevil book.
It was fun, though. It was a brilliant idea.
Here's the thing. Tom Brevoort, who was the editor of it, mentioned it lately on his blog. It's like, yeah, I'd like to read those again. And they're in a box in the storage and whatever and hard to get to and all. So I said, bah, the heck with that. I will just read it on the Marvel's Unlimited app. It's not on there.
Really?
Oh, well, then I'll just pick up the trade paperback that collected it. It's never been collected.
Really?
This is an event that is 22 years old. And I thought, oh, this is going to be impossible to find. And I started looking on, you know, some sites that sell back issues. And here's the weird thing. Nobody had any in near mint. It was the highest that they had on both My Comic Shop and Mile High were very fine. And they were charging $8 each because, you know, they don't have many of them because nobody cared. So, Joe, where did I go to find them?
eBay.
Damn right. I found somebody who had all six books and the promo book that shipped for $15.
Wow. That's not bad.
So they are on their way.
Rarity of the books.
Yeah. And they didn't sell well when they came out. Tom Brevoort said that, you know, he thought it was a fun idea, but it didn't sell well. And mostly because nobody did any promotion because they really didn't quite know how to peg it.
What year? What year was that?
I believe it was 1999. It was either 99 or 2000.
I think they sold well at my shop. But then again, I also remember promoting it. You know, so people picked it up out of curiosity. I don't know if and I just threw away all the invoices. Not that mattered. They were in no real semblance of order. But I do recall it. I probably didn't order super heavy on it. But, and again, if this was one of the weird things I discovered as I was going through my records, Heroes World had this weird idea that they could make you grow your sales by making you order more books, oftentimes done with incentive discounts, sometimes with variant covers, but not so much. So it was always, you know, here is your Marvel growth. You ordered this last month, order this month. And then I imagine when that event come around, assuming, I don't know if Heroes World was still around, they would probably be like, order this in X percentage amount of your Amazing Spider-Man order, and we will give you 20 extra copies. You know, that was kind of their carrot. But, you know, that's ringing a big bell for an event like that. So it might have been that event, might have been a different one.
It was the year 2000.
Heroes World was long gone.
Yeah. Call Him Thor, The History of Marvels, let's see, Guardian of Freedom, Captain America, the world's only 100% authorized comic, The Fantastic Four. They don't list the, Spider-Man. And you've got, you know, Paul Smith working on it, Joe Jusko, Mike Waringo. Tom Grummet, Bob Wyasak, Paul Grist, Peter David. The Captain America book was drawn by Steve Rogers. Because remember in the comic.
Brilliant. Yeah, he was
Steve
writing.
Rogers was drawing Captain America comic. So it was Captain America, Daredevil, Fantastic Four, Iron Man, Thor, and the X-Men. Really looking forward to when that shows up. Believe it or not, kids, you've listened to us blather on about funny books for over 2 hours because, believe it or not, there was a lot of news in comics that most of the news sites just aren't covering for some reason because it's not a press release about an upcoming TV show or movie.
Yeah, makes you want to just snort WD-40, doesn't it?
Makes me angry that they call themselves journalists. And as we say every week, the comic we like the least, we still like better than the comic that you like the most, Joe.
Do a quick shout out. I got some friends starting a podcast where they argue about which cheese is the best. It's named K. So. Hit my music.
Hey, yo. Can somebody call my mama? down, bitches!